This is Iconic.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things Gumshoe. This is the final part of our look at the Swords of the Serpentine. The largest chapter in the book is Chapter 9, The Setting of Eversink. About 80 pages. And we're going to let Mark start us off with, what is Eversink?
In a nutshell, it's a city that is sinking into the marsh. Hence its name, Eversink. The buildings are always sinking. They don't really know why. And you would think, well, it's in a swamp. Yeah, but after 1,000 years, you think, okay, if we built buildings and they slowly sink and we keep building on top of it, eventually it would hit bedrock and be good. And we're not going to continue to sink, but it still continues to sink. The average is about every 50 years, a building's completely gone. And people keep building on top and they talk about how they do that and who lives in the flooded basements and who lives above it and all that. And some are faster, some are slower, but generally it continues to sink. And there's a very fantastic map of Eversink, and it's reminding me a lot of Venice, a lot of canals going through islands, like a big island with a lot of canals through it. The other thing, big thing, is the city and the goddess are one. You live in the goddess. Denari is the city, and the city is Denari, which is very unique. Which is one of the reasons corruption is banned in the city, because if you induce corruption in the city, you're taking away some of the goddess. You're injuring her.
Right.
So it's like no one tolerates that if they know, you know, that might have saved our butts in a fight. But if Becca invoked and got some corruption, she hurt the city. And so we need to keep that on the down low.
Mm-hmm.
I say to Becca because, you know, I play the warrior. I never play a mage.
We all know Becca likes starting cults.
That is true. That is true. The other big thing, there's three big things that really, I think, are about Denari that Eversink. And I would use them, if I ran it, interchangeably. I'd say Eversink, I'd say Denari, because it's one and the same. But statues are everywhere because they represent souls. Being in an island, not having a lot of land, you build a statue, you know, like my warrior dies, I hope my compatriots commission a statue. It might be a wood carving, it might be simple clay, it might be bronze, it might be a marble, depending how much money you have. And that's houses your soul. So the body's disposed of, but that gives you a place in Denari's heaven. Again, because the statues are in the city, they're with the goddess. So if for some reason your friends don't do that, then you might not be with your goddess. So,
but if on the flip side, if the statue gets broken, your soul is no longer at rest.
Yes, which can cause problems depending on who breaks it and who maybe then captures your soul and does some stuff and possession and corruption. And GMs, you need to read this section. Good stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
There's people from all over in Eversink. They've immigrated here. Again, it's in the low marshland next to some fens. It's temperate, full of color. And I would say it just keeps changing because as buildings collapse, they just keep building up and out to where a lot of the streets are overcrowded, more than you'd think of a typical medieval city, because there is no new land. You just keep building on top and build out until you reach your neighbor across the street. So a lot of the street level is very dusky, even at midday, because there's not a lot of sun hitting the streets. And as you would think, those with money live higher up and not in basements or down low where it's nasty. Yeah, and that's pretty much, there's a lot of little things in it, but those are the big things I think about Eversink. Is it's next to a marsh, it's sinking, hence its name, and and the goddess are one.
Yeah. One of the things I love about this is when you're flipping through this chapter, there's at least one plot hook every page, if not multiple plot hooks through the whole thing. Becca, can you give us just an overview of the history of Eversync? Why, and maybe why that's important for us as GMs to kind of keep an eye on?
Yeah. I mean, one of the main reasons why you need a history for your setting is to ground it. And one of the best ways to ground a setting is to have a reason to throw a party. I mean, you know, we have birthdays to celebrate the history of our lives, right? So essentially, you need to have a party every single year to celebrate the birthday of the founding of the city. Before Eversync was created, there were civilizations, there were people, and then the Great Calamity happened. People retreated to this bay, called on the gods, and Denari, the goddess, answered. I do want to read this part because it made me giggle. Because when Denari appears, she you know, says, yeah, with my blessing, I'm going to help you build a new empire. We're going to make it amazing. You can fish here. You can stay here. I'll make you richer than you can dream. She goes, your mortal realm is safe in my hands forever with certain legal conditions. And that is the beginning of the whole market and trades and legalities that Denari thrives upon.
Mm-hmm.
And not just Denari, but Eversync. And so knowing that the history of Eversync is based on a contract really, I think, emphasizes that your players should be thinking about their lives through a series of contracts. You're not trying to save the world. You're trying to fulfill your contract.
I like that.
For whatever that is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really good... Yeah. It's a really good way to view the campaign setting.
Yeah, because in some games, 13th Age, you are the hero. You're out to save the world. But here in Eversync, you're just here to fulfill your contract. The greatest of all contracts, the golden contract, written between the founders and Denari and signed. And in theory, all the noble houses are therefore the descendants of those founders. And in 1,000 years, Denari is going to take another look at that contract and decide whether or not she wants to renew it.
Mm-hmm.
So considering that those 1,000 years are coming up soon, we probably should make sure that our city is in pretty good standing if we want Denari to allow it to continue for another 1,000 years.
Yeah, that would definitely come up in any campaign I ran.
Oh, yeah.
So we're going to gloss over all of the city districts, all of the government things, because that's what you would expect to find in this chapter. It fleshes out the city so that it is a fully playable, yet like much of Pelgrane's RPG lines, it fleshes it out just enough that players and GMs have hooks to hang their own ideas on. This is not water deep laid out on index cards, you know, in 1 foot grids that apparently live somewhere in Ed Greenwood's mind or possibly his realm. This is like the Dragon Empire. It's a lot more detailed than the Dragon Empire, but with that same focus on, we need to make sure that you just have enough to sketch out the district and then change it how you want, add your own things in there. But what I really think is important is the allegiances. And we talked about this earlier in previous episodes. The allegiances function a lot like icons do in 13th Age. And so, kind of briefly, the things that are really important, the factions and the people that are really important in Eversync are the ancient nobility, which are the original aristocracy of the city, the Church of Denari, who obviously worship the goddess, as Mark and Becca explained, the city watch, the commoners, both pretty self-explanatory, the guild of architects and canal watchers. These are the people whose job is to fight against the ever-sinking nature of Eversync. The mercanti, who are the up-and-coming, the guild leaders, the new merchants, what we would call maybe dilettantes or
the rising middle class, if you will. The mercenaries and the monstrosities, again, pretty self-explanatory. The Outlanders, and there's just some great art as I flipped through this. These are people who just don't belong in Eversink or weren't born in Eversink and have made their way into the city and are somehow outside the power structures, yet have kind of created their own hierarchy within the city. The Sorcerer's Cabals and the Thieves Guild. I feel like they give us two pairs of things that are exactly what they say on the tin, and then one that requires a little more, like, right? The Triskaidane. The Triskaidane are the men and women who control the city of Eversink. No one knows who they are. They function a lot like the masked lords of Waterdeep. And those are the factions that you either ally with or you are enemies with. And the combination of players, the players' network of alliances and enemies, forms the network that a GM builds their campaign on, which is awesome, right? It's sort of like when you are running in 13th Age, if no one has an icon relationship with the Orc Lord, you really probably don't need to bring the Orc Lord up if you don't have a really good reason for it. If all of your characters have a relationship with the Crusader, it's definitely time to make the big bad of your campaign somehow related to the Crusader.
For a minute, I thought you were going to say the big bad guy was the Crusader, and that's just wrong, Jam. You got to be a paladin of the Crusader, make things happen.
Mark's got a type, and that type is a Crusader worshiping demonologist at the blood. Kevin and Emily end this section with the tension between internal and external threats. Mark, can you give us a quick overview of what that means and why that's important?
Yeah, it's just, these are just, and it's not a comprehensive list. Again, these are just fantastic ideas. If you're trying to come up, you know, you've got to kind of to borrow from Knights Black Agents, kind of a skeleton of what your adventure is going to look like. And you got some ideas, but you want some threats to throw in there without specific, not, you know, going to the specific adversaries or monsters, just some general things to cause some conflict. And one of them is an external, is the Chuggut, which when I first saw the picture, remind me of Gungans, but they're swamp people that live in the fens. And being outsiders, they obviously are a hostile threat to people from Eversink as they try to go up the Serpentine River. And though they don't normally attack the city, they can, you know, help smugglers and do different things. There's this general class warfare. Talked about nobles, the mercantile, and you've got the common dock worker that's, you know, at the bottom of the rung. So you get this class warfare going, and they're tired of living in flooded basements, and I want to move uphill. There's corruption, which corruption is very bad. We've mentioned it several times. It's you get into be using sorcery, or maybe no one in your group does, but the enemy does. Corruption hurts Denari. So, and it's, that's an easy hire. Hey, we need you to go investigate this because we've detected corruption or something's wrong. There's just the normal disease and plague in here. You know, nothing like getting wet lung and getting pulled into the society of the drowned. Fire, which that's a threat to any city. Floods, refugees, religious crusades, because there's people outside of Eversink who think, no, you need to be put down. This is not a proper religion, and how you run your city is wrong, and we're going to come and free you. So that's another good one. There's a few non-human threats, which, again, it's not going to be orcs, goblins. It's going to be demons that are, you know, brought in by the sorcerers and just more corruption. Then there's just some of these, what they call small gods or spirits, forgotten demons stuff, unlicensed small gods. And you'll find little cults in the city, and those, of course, have to be put down because, you know, we can only have one god. There's your smugglers. If you're going to have a city, smugglers should be always on your list. In general, sorcery, supply chains, trade wars. If the mercantile class is trying to become more powerful in the city, they're probably going to deal with smugglers and They're going to have some trade wars. There's treason and then all-out war. But Eversync, being very mercantile, right from their god or goddess, pay mercenaries, pay off the other people, work trade deals, and it doesn't happen very often that someone actually attacks Eversync, but it can happen. So those are just a few ideas that they threw out there just to kind of give you an idea of here's some conflict to kind of maybe get you going if you don't have a good idea or you're looking for something to throw in. And sometimes it can be a diversion too. As you're hunting down that cult, suddenly there's a fire in the temple district. Oh, that's not good. And then, you know, the golden charter, it goes missing. That would be bad.
Yeah, I feel like I really need to run a long-term campaign of this game. For less than 400 pages, they have given you a setting and a system that can last for years. They give you a world, but to put it in perspective, Eversync gets 80 pages. The rest of the world gets 20. The world is covered in a pretty high gloss. We're not going to go into details about it because I think, again, Swords of the Serpentine is about Eversync. But it's just enough for you if you want to play an Outlander, if you want to have rumors of things that are going on, or if you want an adventure to go there, you have a gloss of what's going on there. It's sort of like in the Fawford and Greymouser stories. They're really about Lankmar. But from time to time, they leave Lankmar and go and do other things. And then they come back to Lankmar.
And I'm hoping Kevin and Emily maybe come out with some other supplements dealing with other areas.
Oh, yeah.
Make your, you know, hey, we need to set a trade deal with the Vantavani horse lords. Vantavani horse lords to the west. So you sail across there and try not to get hit by the pirates of Min and try to help make a trade deal. Again, might be one of those mercantile houses who are trying to bring in whatever they have over there to get an up on the other families.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a lot of expansion if you want to throw it out, or, you know, can always hope that they come up with a few things.
That's one of my questions that I'm preparing for the interview is that, hey, what's next for Swords of the Serpentine? So the last section of this book, and again, it is not a insignificant section. The last section of this book is about 30 pages. There's a 30-page adventure at the end of this book. It's called Corpse Astray. And we're going to let Becca tell us about this adventure. What is Corpse Astray about, high level, and what were your thoughts on it as a GM?
Yeah, high level, they are astray. And the reason why they are astray, as I go now one level in, is because somebody is trying to collect all the corpses in order to, you know, enact a revenge against our grandparents, because we're always angry at those who come before us, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's an introductory adventure that's supposed to help both GMs and players figure out how scenes run, how the game works, how fights are designed, and it should be able to be played in 3 to 4 hours. And it begins with just the players all on a boat. And there's a lot of great hooks to get players involved. Players can know the big bad of the pirate crew, the pirate captain. And there's something odd about her. She's not acting the way all the stories have proclaimed her to be. And you find out she is making as many corpses as possible. And from there, you kind of start to follow that trail, right? Like, where are these corpses going? What's going on? You meet people who are trying to make monstrosities and undead things. And you'll probably traumatize players. Yeah, like, it's a great adventure because it gives you a moment where the heroes can stop what is happening before things get really bad. But if they don't, in that like fail forward momentum, I can easily see a way to get this going into like a full campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, this one person or this one small group of people were creating this corpse monstrosity thing. Why was it them? Is more going on? Who else wants to do this? What does that have to do with the fact that in 5 years, the golden contract is getting renewed? Like, you can absolutely run with it. I don't want to say too much more about this adventure because I don't want to spoil.
Yeah, and like maybe who taught him, because he doesn't start out knowing how to do this, but who taught him that? What cult kind of leaked this information to cause? That's perfect for cult. Hey, we're going to teach you to do this because you have your own motives and it's going to do what we want, but there's no connection to us.
Let's wrap up and we'll start with you, Mark. What are your thoughts on Swords of the Serpentine? Now that we've gone through the whole thing, what's your favorite part, biggest takeaway?
Well, one, I like it. I would play in it. I wouldn't be adverse to running it. You have to find, you know, each group, you got to find a group of players that are willing to get into this kind of a fantasy setting versus the normal, you could say, hack and slash of some of the other D20 ones. But I think it would be a lot of fun to play in or run. I like that it just seems to, like you said, instead of having, and I like that, you know, kick the door down, kill monsters. We've played that before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, loot their corpses, go back with the treasure. We played 13th Age. We played Knights Black Agents. I'm running Knights Black Agents. So I kind of like this style of, it gives you so much flexibility, I
think,
with the investigative abilities and allowing, and with their suggestions of, well, you can't really do that. Well, what are you willing to do? Okay, well, here's the consequences for it. And sometimes it's not even like they describe, like, okay, you know, busting down the door, you're hurt for the fight. You have to remember consequences for everything. I like it. I don't have really one part. I like the whole way they put it together and, you know, between special abilities and some of the adversaries, I like more of the subterfuge part of it than the hack and slay. You know, it might be some fights, but it'd be more of finding out what's going on and who's behind it. You kind of pass it off to the authorities or not, you know. Take down the city yourself, I guess.
Right.
Depending on your bent.
Becca, what about you?
Yes. I enjoy the whole concept of sword and sorcery. I think it's that fantasy, ideal that, you know, you read about and you go, yeah, like sword and sorcery, like standing up for the little people, taking on the monsters, figuring out the mystery, and being the hero. I enjoy those types of stories. I think in Gumshoe in general, it's all about the mystery. And so if you're not interested in uncovering a mystery, I don't think Gumshoe is the type of game for you.
That's fair.
I do enjoy mysteries. And if you have a good group who's ready to do a mystery, then I think you're all set. I would enjoy playing in a Swords of the Serpentine game. I would enjoy doing a long-term game, I think, and looking at how things happen in a city, especially a merchant-based city, where there's always a cost to anything that you want. And whether that cost is your wealth or your soul is always debatable. I enjoy the style. I enjoy the game. I would definitely run that adventure as an introductory. I think it's a great introductory adventure to get people hooked into the themes of Swords of the Serpentine.
Well, I think, you know, if everybody dies in the RuneQuest game, we'll just play Swords of the Serpentine. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but Mark is convinced that everyone's going to get eaten by a octopus. So that brings us to the end of this episode. I obviously love Swords of the Serpentine. I hope that came through as I was discussing over the last 5 episodes on this. I can't wait to interview Kevin and Emily. And because of that interview, we're actually going to change some things up, because season 7 is coming for the Iconic Podcast, and season 7 is going to be a departure, much like season 6 was. Season 7, we're going back to 13th Age, but we will be running a 13th Age actual play show for season 7. We're getting some new software next month that'll allow us to record in a different way, that'll allow me to record each person individually so I can split up if things get talked over. We're gonna stream it live. It's gonna be streamed with Foundry, so there won't be any, you won't see us, you'll just see our character art. But we're going to stream it and then cut it down. We're gonna use the 13th Age soundtrack. We're gonna push it out in edited down pretty tight chunks going forward. But it's going to be myself as the GM, Becca and Mark as two of the principal players, good friend of the show and fellow co-host of the Exploring Glorantha podcast, Evan, and then our very special guest, Becca's best friend, Rob Hainso. And so we are going to be playtesting 13th Age 2nd Edition. So I hope to every quarter do a behind the screen where we talk about things we've learned, questions we want to ask for the playtest. I know the playtest packets have gone out, so if you have yet to see them, sign up for the playtest. There should be a new version of it rolling out here soon. And please, please, please fill out the playtest survey, because I know there are people who are looking at it, because I am one of the people looking at it, as is Rob and Jonathan. So we'll be back in 2 weeks with our interview with Kevin and Emily. So until then, stay safe, stay healthy, stay gaming. Thank you to Mark and Becca always for your insights, for your banter, for your willingness to take a 400-page book and speed read it over 2 months. Have a good one. And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by becoming a patron at patreon.com/iconicpodcast.
You've been listening to the Iconic Podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, you can contact us at iconicpodcast@gmail.com. Also, check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and more information about the show. Thanks for listening.